Psychologist Clark McCauley has been studying terrorist groups and lone actor extremists for years. And one thing he's discovered is that most of them are not monsters. In fact, they share many of the same values and motivations as the rest of us. Because a lot of the time, it's not ideology that compels people to commit terrorist acts, it's social bonds.
Most of us belong to many groups. But when your whole social world contracts down to just one particular group, an underground cell of some kind, then the power of that group to set norms and determine morality is just unlimited. You get to see that same kind of horsepower with small groups in combat.
But you're not suggesting that there is something similar with terrorists, really?
That I am suggesting that. The group dynamics of an intense small group in combat is very similar to the group dynamics of an intense small terrorist cell. Both of them are cut off from all other kinds of social influence, and both of them are completely dependent on their survival, for their survival, on these few people around them.
And usually the way we tell those stories, it's about the process of radicalization. So you get, you know, young people who've come, whether from the U.S. or the U.K. or Western Europe, and who've been, you know, come under the influence of maybe a powerful leader. And they've been deeply influenced by that person. It seems like more of an authority power structure and power dynamic to me than a small band of brothers. I don't know. Is there a difference there?
Well, it is true that a lot of people talk just the way you were mentioning, that basically the problem is some charismatic and probably evil person who influences young and impressionable people. But actually, there's very little of that. It's people looking for a group to join or looking for a way to express their concern about victimization, as they see it, of people that they care about. So an amazing amount of it is bottom-up as opposed to top-down, and we can't really understand the problem if we're going to insist on talking about it as a top-down, charismatic influence problem.
Now, you also said you weren't crazy about thinking of it in terms of psychopathology, but I mean, surely there's some degree of delusional thinking or obsession or irrationality.
No, very seldom amongst the people who are members of a group. But there is one exception. Mm-hmm. So there is at least one profile of lone actor terrorist, which does involve some psychopathology. This is a profile that Sofia Moskalenko and I have called disordered disconnected. These are people who tend to be loners, or they've recently lost their social connections. They have some history of mental disorder, especially depression, and they have a grievance. And what that amounts to is if you're suffering from some grievance as you see it, and if you are suffering from some kind of psychopathology, that means you're not a happy person, you don't have very much to lose in acting on your grievance.
But you said there's another kind of lone wolf terrorist. There are two categories?
Yes. The other profile that we have suggested is a caring, compelled profile. There are examples of lone actor terrorists who have no history of mental disorder, who have good social connections, family and friends and work, but who seem to be capable of more intense sympathy and empathy than most of us. And they feel so strongly. Their emotional reaction to the suffering of others as they see it, the people they see being victimized, their reaction is so strong that they just feel like they have got to do something. Now, this is a little hard for most people to get hold of, I admit, because it amounts to saying that there's a potential dark side to qualities that we usually think of as quintessentially human and mm-hmm. humane, empathy and sympathy. Who could not appreciate empathy and sympathy in an individual? But we're suggesting there are some people who feel so strongly that they just can't help. They have to do something. So, you know, Momin Khawaja, a Canadian-Pakistani terrorist, who was convicted of complicity in a bomb plot in the UK. He's this kind of a person. He's smart. He's hardworking. He's got great social connections. He had a good job. So he's one of these examples of somebody who doesn't fit the disconnected, disordered. We think he fits the caring, compelled. He just is the kind of person who feels super strong about the suffering of others.
Tell me more about him, because this is a case that I'm not that familiar with. And as you said, there is something just so startling about the idea that something as fundamentally inhumane as terrorism could come out of some of our most human emotions, sympathy and compassion. So how do you see that playing out in Mohmand Khawaja's story?
Well, he lived in a Muslim subculture and community in Ottawa, where pretty much everybody agreed that the Palestinians were victimized by the Israelis, that the invasion of Afghanistan was a victimization of Muslims in Afghanistan, and then the invasion of Iraq was the victimization of still more Muslims. And he is a Muslim, and he watched videos of the sufferings of these people. Now, if you're the kind of person who feels deeply and you watch these kinds of videos, then you're going to feel this powerful urge. These people are suffering. It's outrageous. I've got to do something.
Well, it strikes me that those same feelings that you're talking about often inspire people to do proactive, pro-humane things, save refugees, feed the homeless, cure diseases, work with, you know, victims of trauma. So what determines why, you know, somebody like Mohmand Khawaja is going to respond to injustice by wanting to blow people up versus wanting to go do something good?
Well, it's often an accident of the social situation that an individual is in. So here's Mohmand Khawaja, and he's in a situation where pretty much everybody around him agrees that it's terrible what's happening to Muslims. His father is an academic. In particular, his specialty is intergroup conflict and cultural conflict. And he's been trained to think about this problem intellectually, mm-hmm. academically, to try to respond to it in the world of ideas. But his son doesn't have that kind of academic training. His son doesn't have this kind of experience thinking about conflict and its outcomes and its consequences and its origins. And he doesn't have that kind of intellectual equipment to work with. So for him, the father's way is a cop-out. Action is what's required. Anything that isn't action is hypocrisy.
But how come Mohmand's capacity for sympathy and empathy didn't lead him to look sympathetically or empathetically at his potential victims?
Well, because he's focused on the victims that he cares about. I mean, you could say that there's something similar goes on in the U.S. when we have reported collateral damage that's done by U.S. attacks in mostly these days in Muslim countries. So why is it that we aren't more concerned? Well, it has to do with who you care most about. It has to do with who you love.
You know, the funny thing is you're making terrorists sound like normal people.
That's what I've been trying to argue for 10 years now. They're not psychopathology. They're not evil. They're people like you and me who have been put in situations we should hope we never are put in.
Would you go so far as to say none of us is immune to that kind of transformation?
Well, there may be a few psychopaths, selfish people who are immune, but yes, the great majority of us and normal people, we are susceptible to it because at the bottom, you see, it's not hate that's at the bottom of intergroup violence. It's love. It's love for the in-group. So every one of us who really loves somebody, relative, friend, and who really love a particular group, anybody who really loves is capable of anger and outrage when the people they see that they love are being victimized, harmed, unjustly hurt. It's, I would say, almost the default.
So it sounds like These are crimes that begin with enormous sympathy and empathy for, you know, a victimized population. And the ideology sort of comes later. The agenda for how we do something about it is secondary.
I think that's right, but we got to be a little careful about what we mean by ideology. I mean, I think a great deal of intergroup violence is as simple as they did it to us, they're not going to get away with it. We're going to do it back to them so they can see what it's like. Now, I don't call that ideology. I call that something like the reciprocity rule.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, human beings, and these are normal human beings we're talking about, I keep insisting, normal human beings don't kill other normal human beings without having some story to tell to themselves and to tell to others as to why they're doing it. And I think a lot of people turn from they can't get away with it to, oh, yes, and here's a more complex rationale that comes to the same conclusion, that they can't get away with it and we're going to have to deal with these people and so on and so forth. We're saving our society or our culture or whatever. So, yes, we do get to see ideology in almost every extended intergroup conflict, especially if it involves violence. But from what I can see, and my own opinion is, it's more often rationalization than it is a cause.
Clark McCauley is a psychologist and the co-author of Friction: How Radicalization Happens to Them and Us.